Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Arun Vanagopal in for Tanzina Vega. Good to have you with us.
Chaotic, divisive, toxic, exhausting.
I don't care how much money Mayor Bloomberg has. The Democratic Party will never trust him.
I don't know what else she wants us to do.
Oh, I'll be clear.
Mayor Bloomberg has a solid and strong and enthusiastic base of support. Problem is, they're all billionaires.
You talk about what we're talking about with Bernie. Bernie, in fact, hasn't passed much of anything.
Joe has voted for terrible trade agreements.
The math does not add up.
And that's why Russia is helping you get elected, so you'll lose to him.
With the South Carolina primary just days away, seven of the remaining Democratic presidential hopefuls talked over each other and sparred for the better part of 2.5 hours. And while at the previous debate, the most pointed criticism was directed at Michael Bloomberg, this time around, frontrunner Bernie Sanders came under attack.
I'm hearing my name mentioned a little bit tonight. I wonder why. And maybe, you know, Pete mentions what the American people want. I will tell you, Pete, what the American people want, and Joe, what the American people want. They don't want candidates to be running to billionaires for huge amounts of funding.
After a dominant win in Nevada and two strong showings in Iowa and New Hampshire, the Vermont senator is the candidate to beat in the primaries. But his strength heading into South Carolina has also highlighted potential fractures within the Democratic Party. In recent weeks, some centrist Democrats have voiced growing alarm at the prospect of a Sanders nomination. An ad released last week by the moderate Democratic super PAC, the Big Tent Project, highlighted some of those concerns in an attempt to undercut support for Sanders.
Socialist Bernie Sanders promises the world, but at what cost? $60 trillion in new spending. The cost? Another 4 years of Donald Trump.
Now, all of this may just be primary politics as usual, but it could also spell trouble for the Democrats and their ability to unify behind a single candidate against President Trump as we head towards November. For more, I'm joined now by Laura Barón López, national reporter for Politico. Laura, thanks for coming back on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is R.T. Ryback, former mayor of Minneapolis and a former vice chairman of the Democratic National Committee from 2012 to 2016. Thanks for being here, R.T.
Happy to be here.
Laura, let's start with last night's debate. Did any of the critiques of Sanders by his rivals stand out to you?
Not particularly. I mean, the one, though, that we heard last night that will probably carry forward the most into Super Tuesday and beyond is the attacks on his self-described democratic socialism. And that's where Democrats consider him the weakest. It's something that Mike Bloomberg is playing up a lot, especially with Democrats in the House. It's something also that Biden has been playing up as they try to consolidate moderate Democrats around them and consolidate that vote in the hopes that they could potentially blunt Sanders' rise, because he's been rising very fast and suddenly. And a lot of moderate Democrats have been surprised by this, and they're starting to get worried. I was talking to some House Democrats who are on the ground in South Carolina right now, and they told me that there is a sense of concern about Sanders' rise, but they aren't really sure what to do because none of the moderates are dropping out.
RT, do you think Sanders looked vulnerable last night, or does the pile on from all of his opponents actually help him?
Well, you know, I think it's easy to describe this in terms of a wrestling match and piling on, and I get it, and it looks like it. But, you know, the Democrats are different than Republicans. The Republicans have only one person on the ballot. The Democrats are a little bit more like kind of like a family at Thanksgiving. You know, you yell at each other for about 3 hours, then you hug and kiss on the way out. And that's, I think, actually a really important part of the process, because think back to Obama running, and think back when the worst thing that could possibly drop on him, the whole Reverend Wright controversy. And out of that came one of the most incredible speeches in American history. So He was tested and he succeeded. And what you're seeing right now is the testing. And if Bernie Sanders can answer the charges that are a lighter version of what will be thrown at him in the fall, I think that will mean that he's ready to go. And if not, he won't. And I think that's the history of the party. And I think it's what you're going to see again this year.
Laura, Sanders has done well in Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada. So he's the only candidate who's had success in those first two predominantly white states, but also among Nevada's more diverse electorate. What does that tell us about the strength of his campaign?
It helps Sanders take away some of Biden's argument, or the argument that Biden has been trying to make this entire cycle, which is that Joe Biden, who was the presumptive front runner up until Iowa, up until we saw voters actually cast their ballots in caucus, his argument was that he was the only candidate that could win black and brown voters, that he was the candidate who could build an Obama-like diverse coalition. And so with Sanders's dominant win in Nevada, where he won more than half of the Latino vote, also gained more of the Asian vote than Biden. Biden did do better with black voters in Nevada than Sanders, but not by much. Sanders also won a noticeable chunk of black voters. It helped Sanders' argument that he can build a diverse coalition. That being said, some of Sanders' promises, which is that he could bring out young voters in greater numbers, hasn't really materialized. Now, it's harder to bring out young voters in caucus states like Iowa and Nevada. Those are far more time-intensive voting systems. You have to spend, you know, hours of your day caucusing. And so more likely than not, young voters aren't going to turn out as much when it comes to a caucus. It'll be interesting to see whether or not Sanders is able to really eat away at Biden's black support in South Carolina, and how many of those black voters are young voters that turn out.
RT, you think that the process of, I guess, the disagreements among the candidates is a productive one. Is there reason to believe that some of these disagreements will become fodder, effective fodder, for President Trump once we get closer to the convention and after that?
There's no question about it, but it's not as if the Democratic candidates are going to be inventing attacks against each other. Everybody knows what the attacks are, so it's not as if it's going to be a state secret. So bring them out early is, I guess, the best way of talking about it. I want to be clear, though. I think the debate last night missed many and most of the big issues, and that's not the fault of the candidates. That's the fault of the moderators on that. So, you know, we've got an impeachment going. We've got, well, I mean, let's lay out the laundry list. None of these issues came up. Jay Inslee, you know, run a really great campaign talking about climate change, criticized the DNC last night for not talking about climate. Well, pull up DNC and say CBS. It's really important right now for us to have an honest conversation. You can't go into back rooms and make these choices. And these people who think that somehow there's this monolithic establishment sitting out there that's going to settle this don't understand the way the DNC works.
Well, I mean, tell us more about that. I mean, basically, how you know, non-hierarchical is it then?
Well, you know, my experience of this, by the way, I'm not supporting any candidate this time. I'm not on the DNC. I didn't have a lot of party experience, so I was an Obama supporter, and he appointed me vice chair. So I'm kind of like dropped into this, expecting, frankly, that there would be this big monolithic group. But that's not really the way it works. It's a series of people elected across the country. And over the last couple of years, what's happened is that more and more Sanders people have been part of it. So when Bernie Sanders is talking about the Democratic establishment, he's talking about many of his own supporters. You know, just in the last election for a chair, Keith Ellison ran against Tom Perez. It was sort of a surrogate for Hillary Bernie, and it was almost a tie. And it probably would have been a complete tie had there not been this third candidate, Pete Buttigieg, running. And you can walk back with Democrats throughout, you know, the last, going way back to Humphrey. Humphrey won the nomination in '68 without running in a primary. after that, and of course you remember Chicago exploded, there have been a series of reforms, and it's now, some people say chaos, but I call it democratic.
Laura, what's the message you're hearing from moderate Democrats? Are they growing more alarmist in recent weeks?
Yes, they are. They are increasingly concerned about Sanders winning the nomination, and they're frustrated that they have too many moderates to choose from, which is splitting the votes. And from what I've heard from them this week is that they feel as though after Super Tuesday, they're hoping that clears the field and that House Democrats and other moderates across the country can get behind one centrist candidate, be it Biden or Bloomberg, or if there's a surprise, maybe Buttigieg or Klobuchar, although it's increasingly looking as though those last two candidates I mentioned don't have as good of a pathway to the nomination. Their thought is that if somehow this reaches a brokered convention, which everyone always thinks it's going to and then it never does, but if somehow it reaches a brokered convention, that eventually, if Sanders does not get the threshold that he needs of delegates to win the nomination and he just gets a plurality, that on the second ballot, that's when all of these superdelegates we're talking about, House lawmakers, governors, senators, get their superdelegate powers back. And then that's when they would have influence. It's a long road from now to then. Right now, it is looking as though Sanders would meet the threshold. But again, if enough delegates split up on Super Tuesday, there's a very real chance that we could enter the convention not knowing who exactly the nominee is.
And among those moderate voters you've been talking to, is there reason to believe a significant number of them would just be scared off by a Sanders nomination?
If it were to somehow reach a brokered convention and they got their power back, I would be very surprised if they voted as a superdelegate to give Sanders the nomination. The argument from moderates and from candidates like Bloomberg and Biden is that Sanders would have a negative impact on down-ballot Democrats, would have a negative impact on their House majority. You could argue that that's a bit alarmist and that there's really no telling how Sanders could have an impact on the electorate. That he definitely rallies the base. And so in a way, he could maybe have an impact like Trump did on the right and motivate Democrats to come out to vote.
Laura Barrón-López is a national reporter for Politico, and R.T. Ryback is former vice chairman of the Democratic National Committee in 2016. Laura and R.T., thanks so much.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.